Hello, everybody. It's great to be here one more time today. My name is Gary Fowler. I'm the CEO, president, founder of GSD, Get Shit Done Venture Studios, a premier AI and quantum venture studio located in the heart of Silicon Valley. I'm a 17-time serial entrepreneur with several unicorns under the belt. I was on the original management team of Click Software, which was sold to Salesforce for $1.35 billion, and also Eva.ai, your virtual assistant, one of the first generative AI companies that Dr. David Yang and I founded in 2016. We believe at GSD that intellectual capacity is evenly spread around the world, but opportunities are not. And there's some very cool companies around the world that we seek out for top global startups. And today, Ben Loria is one of them with his company, Harundo. So I'm going to bring Ben on board. So Ben, how are you today?
Hey, Gary. Great to see you. Happy to be here.
Now, you know, you describe Harundo's technology as AI neurosurgery. What moment or insight sparked the idea that AI models needed to forget rather than just be firewalled?
All right. So as a quick recap, we're the first company in the world to offer a machine unlearning product, a neurosurgery for AI. We can retroactively remove any unwanted data or behaviors from trained AI models. So, quote unquote, teaching AI how to forget. For us, you know, we started as a startup like in the classic way of just interviewing many, many different teams dealing with AI, both data science, responsible AI, CISO, stuff like this. And obviously they are all dealing with some different problems, but there's one clear, a common denominator. And that's the fact that AI training is a one-way track, right? So when I give public talks, I do this gimmick of presenting a video of a pink elephant to the audience, tell the audience to not remember this pink elephant. And of course, that's the only thing that people remember from my talk. And then I make the analogy that it's the same with AI. Once you feed data during training phase or fine tuning, the model remembers it. And two things happen. First of all, the model knows certain information from its data and remembers it. Second of all, the model develops certain traits and behavior that become very inherent to it, but could be problematic. Could be biases, hallucinations, vulnerabilities, and so forth. And when we started a startup, we kept hearing about these problems that arise in AI models, but the moment that they arise, it's already too late to fix them. So data science teams need to go back to square one and just redo the entire training of the model or redo the fine tuning, which as AI models get more advanced and bigger, it takes much more time. So it could take hours, days, weeks, and so forth. And even when you're trying to fix it, it's a shot in the dark. So if there was a solution that could remediate issues at the model level, really at the weight level itself, but fix these issues at the core without having to retrain the models, obviously it will bring much faster results for many enterprises that uses AI, will make AI safer, and it will allow wider adoption of AI in enterprise, which is the holy grail. Everyone wants to use AI, but the risks are still too heavy sometimes to use it properly.
So you're given an amnesia.
Selective amnesia, I'll say. You know, there's many different analogies. Some call it lobotomy, which is even scarier than amnesia. Yeah. My favorite analogies are Men in Black, the memory eraser pen, or Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind, to forget about your ex.
An interesting story. So I was with Andrew Straczynski, who's a right-hand man to Rupert Murdoch. We had dinner out in Palo Alto, California. And Larry Page's brother, Carl, was there. And very interesting story. He said he studied 3,000 entrepreneurs. And he said, I understand a lot of characteristics of what are the best entrepreneurs. And I said, what's one thing that they all have in common? So across the board, and he said amnesia. They never talk about the past. Never. And, my billionaire friends, the same. Right. They only talk about, it's only for a matter of reference, the past. It's not like he said, it's like an anchor holding the ship back. If you want your anchor down, you can't move. So just FYI, just the one lesson that I've learned, that's my pink elephant, because I was there listening to it. And I thought he's right, because that's how I am. Right. It's just let it go.
Yeah. I just watched Ted Lasso quite late, and I saw he makes a reference at some episode to be a goldfish. Because goldfish are supposedly the animal with the shortest memory in nature. So whenever the players are failing, they should get back out there. So agreeing.
That's it. I mean, the thing is, if it holds you back, it holds you back. That's unfortunately about 90% of the population lets it hold them back, right? They never go forward. It's interesting. So, you know, you've gone from policy and a Rhodes Scholar background and a deep AI infrastructure work. And how's that multidisciplinary journey shaped the way you approach technology challenges?
Right. So at Hirono, we bring a very interdisciplinary team of leadership, right? So I think that from one end, a lot of the reasons that we're here is because ICON maybe as a bit of like, a wild card to this journey. It's a deep tech startup, first and foremost. We're developing deep technology, more than 7 US patents filed, trying to solve a technological challenge that has been under scientific research for more than 10 years at this point. So we have like my policy background, which is more innovation, strategy, international relations, and so forth. I'm a storyteller, but I couldn't have launched this startup without my co-founders and the fact that they bring the scientific acumen that is needed when we're solving such a challenge. So for reference, our chief scientist was the Dean of Computer Science and Executive VP at the Technion that you mentioned earlier in our brief call before. Right, so he started working on AI before I was born.
Most people don't know. Tell them a little bit about Technion because a lot of people won't know
how
amazing it is. Go ahead.
It's true. And like, I need to remember this because in Israel, you know, people are stunned when they hear about it. So the Technion is so like Israel's MIT, right? So the leading technical university, amazing, incredible research that comes out of there every year, the most talented researchers and so forth, and ranked quite high globally. Professor Emeritus Sodet Shmueli, our chief scientist, is basically one of the most renowned and acclaimed computer scientists coming from Israel, which is by itself, obviously, a computer science hub. Our CTO was previously a graduate researcher under Oded's supervision and a friend of mine. He was also an award-winning R&D officer for the Israeli government. Right. So on one end, I want to say that it's very important to bring this interdisciplinary approach. And I think like the fact that I can bring these very, very complex ideas down to the ground is what makes the difference when we're about market education and introducing this new concept to infrastructure. And at the same time, obviously, this is a research-led company by the supervision of Oded, right? So this is very important because what we're doing is we're not building a classic B2B SaaS. We're not doing an API wrapper around an LLM model. We're actually driving to its core, really looking at the deepest layers of AI and trying to challenge some of the core assumptions. And I thought together as a team, we still like managed to bring all aspects to the front, both like bringing it to action, making it a product, teaching the market about it, but also bringing the best technology that there is right now in the market around this field.
You know, so I actually have a multi-agent large language model that actually is continuously sensing when I'm talking to you right now. And it's going down. It's like my grandmother. So it's analyzing it. It just came to me and said, beyond guardrails, you mentioned that guardrails are like Band-Aids while unlearning is surgery. Can you give a concrete example of a situation where unlearning outperforms external guardrails?
Absolutely. So I will say, we say that guardrails are Band-Aid, but I'll take a step back and I'll say we believe that guardrails are an inherent part.
Tell people what guardrails are, because not I have wide audience in the world. What are guardrails?
Okay, so when we talk about AI adoption in general, right, you have the base models, they could be open weight, meaning the enterprises using these AI models have so like full control over it. They could be provided by OpenAI, Anthropic, and so forth. And then usually they don't deploy it immediately to the customer. There's a set of like a layer of either monitoring or guardrail solution that basically acts as sort of like an active firewall. It tracks the inputs and outputs of the model, sees what the user asks or sends to the model, make sure that it's safe, non-adversarial, non-problematic, sometimes also edits it or blocks problematic inputs, and then does the same for the outputs to make sure that the outputs are not violating company policy, strictly aligned with compliance, safe, and so forth. Right, and we believe—
Ben, I just want one thing. So I've had it happen to me recently that it's actually jumped the guardrails, right? So I was doing something and it jumped it and it pulled some information out that that I wouldn't have expected it to pull out, right? So tell us about that. Tell us, are there instances when, because it's important for people to know, instances when the AI jumps over the guardrails and what happens?
Absolutely. So the problem is that this is an external layer of defense, right? but ML still knows things that it perhaps shouldn't know. I have access to things that are quite sensitive and thinks or acts in ways that are either unexpected or undesired at times. And you know, you experience it firsthand. I would say the industry is filled with examples when people manage to manipulate ChatGPT into giving instructions on how to build a Molotov cocktail or giving like non-sensitive responses and so forth. Because again, the problem is what the model knows, how the model acts. So given that guardrails are faulty, not because they're not good, but because this is only one layer of defense, we believe that the next step in AI infrastructure will also be a level of remediating the model itself, right? So if your model disclosed sensitive information or went out of alignment, we believe that the next step that fitted is to edit the model itself, remove all the unwanted information that the model knows, and also change its behavior so it acts exactly the same way in the aspects that you want it to act, but forgets the bad behaviors that make it go out of alignment. And you asked for like real examples, so I will say we have some crazy stats that blew even our minds at the theme. So on models like Llama 3, the small version of it, we reduced the amount of successful prompt injections. Prompt injection is basically an attack against LLM, trying to manipulate it to give answers that it shouldn't give. So we reduced by 85% the amount of successful prompt injections without guardrails, right? And it's much more robust, it's future looking, and it applies to also zero-day vulnerabilities, meaning vulnerabilities that are not yet known. But because we make the model just act in a more behaved sense, deflecting this kind of attacks using our approach, if you put on learning plus guardrails, for example, your model will be nearly flawless in that sense. Whereas using only guardrails today, everyone is experiencing that, and that's the only approach currently that's commonly used. And it's just not enough because you're trying to cage a wild beast and eventually it will find its way out.
I mean, it did it for me. It got private phone numbers and that kind of thing. I was astounded, actually, what it had pulled out. And I don't know how it did it, right? And so these kind of things, as these systems get more and more intelligent, they're going to be able to find out ways. And and then you start putting quantum computers and you start putting the AI together, you're talking about something that's 100 million times faster, which means what would take 10,000 years. These are real statistics, takes 200 seconds. People don't realize how powerful these tools are going to be in the not too distant future, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, like a lot of deeper questions than unlearning and AI, but I'm optimistic about the future.
Well, here's the thing. You know, I've written a lot of articles. I've written 700 articles, right? And a lot of them before ChatGPT, because everybody can write articles with ChatGPT and Grok and all this. But one of the things that happens, you know, I started saying if we take a Skinnerian psychology approach, operant conditioning, combine it with Rogerian humanistic, and then tokenize it, we can actually build models with empathy and compassion, like our grandmothers, right? They care about us. And you know, that is imperative that we start to do it, because if we take a pragmatic approach, which we've done, nothing good is going to happen. You know what I mean? If we start mimicking human behavior, we don't treat each other right a lot of times. And, and you know, we need to go down through and make sure whatever right is, that we're doing it. And so in each culture, it's a little bit different, but those are going to be the kind of things that we have to think about: empathy and compassion, caring about one another. Sometimes we forget. It's the most important thing.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I think like it reminds me of a lot of our work is also on bias reduction. And you know, bias is all like a losing battle because everyone's trying to understand how to better curate data sets, how to prevent it from the get-go. But the bottom line is, if you train your model on real-world data, and the world is filled with biases and inherent traits and problematic things, obviously the LLMs are going to adopt similar characteristics that are problematic when you evaluate them, but you're not going to evaluate each and every single human being and rank it in the same way. So it's all like an inherent problem of like if AI should reflect what we know, all of the available human knowledge, and resemble in one way or another the human way of thinking, it's going to carry the same problems. And then I think like smarter, more advanced ways to solve it will appear.
Yeah, but the thing is, we got to be careful that it doesn't get slicker on the other side. And so, you know, because, you know, when you look at it, because, you know, we put a lot of weight. I mean, think about it. By 2050, we had to double the food supply. We can't increase the number of cattle because 26% of the pollution is methane gas from cows. Door number one, we got 8.1 billion people, estimated to be 13 billion by the end of the century. The average sea levels by the year 3000, if things keep going the way they are now, could be up 198 feet, right? Because you're talking about the Arctic slope and Greenland melting. Best case scenario that it's somewhere around, you know, 15 meters. Well, you can take a place like Haifa, right? An increase of 15 meters, you're talking about place of one underwater, right? Mumbai. So we need to go down through. And then the other thing is a food supply, right? What happens when you start, these temperatures start changing and as they are, and all of a sudden, you know, our lives have to change to be reflected because we can't grow food outside because it's too hot, right? So what do you need to do? You got to build facilities. You got to do hydroponics. We got to take from the farm to the table, and we've got to optimize because we're throwing a lot of crap away in our refrigerator. 30% of what you go in your refrigerator gets thrown out. It's insane, right? And so we need to figure out how to work together. And it's one thing, you know, I don't know about you, Ben, but, you know, I've lived all over the world. I lived in Russia for a while, 12 years. You know, I've been all over the planet Earth, literally. And the one thing about it is, and my grandmother was Greek, born in Egypt, actually, and moved to the U.S. She was Coptic Orthodox, moved over to the U.S. You know, as we were going down through that journey, you start to understand we're all pretty much the same, aren't we? And yet at the same time, we need to have some guidance. Do you think, Ben, that we're going to get to a point? It's very interesting for me, right? And it's a philosophical point. Yeah. Do you think that the AI is going to, you know, I remember a Star Trek a long time ago where the AI was like God, seriously. And I'm not trying to, you know, do any religious kind of thing, but literally get to a point where it becomes that benevolent that it tries to help us, to be able to guide us so we do the right things?
Well, I think, like, first of all, again, like as I said earlier, I'm optimistic about the future of AI, the future of humanity, and so forth. Like a lot of the challenges that you mentioned, I think, like, we don't know yet how they're going to be solved, but same as the predictions in London, I think, like, in the 1800s were that at some point the city will be covered, you know, in a couple of meters of horse manure, and then cars appeared, right? So eventually smart people are working on solving this problem. I think, like, more smart people and more resources need to be put there, but the solutions will come, and sometimes from unexpected places. And regarding, so, like, the question of AI and its benevolence, right? So I would say AI is a powerful tool. And at the end of the day, power is always used in good ways, but we also need to acknowledge that it's used in not so good ways. And I think, like, we need to separate it into two different kinds of questions. First of all, will AI become this super, super intelligence that we think of it, that will surpass human intelligence? You mentioned empathy, will also encompass these sort of traits and emotions. And the second thing is, like, will it reach that status of being used for good once it is that powerful? Regarding the question, the first question.
Whatever, you know, good is, Ben. The problem is whatever good is, right?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, exactly.
Some people like matzo ball soup. Some people like to have hummus, some people like to have lamb. There's all kinds of different people on the planet, whatever good is. But, you know, one thing we can do is we can live longer because of it, because we can do, you know, drug discovery at a rate we've never been able to do before. We can understand the problems that we have, infobesity, right? In Ben's world, you have about 300,000 items in your personal cloud, Ben. The entire web in 1996 was 257,000 websites. You have more information in your personal cloud, Ben, than in the entire web in 1996, growing at a relative same trajectory, but that I mean doubling every year. In 5 years, you're going to have 10 million. Now, Ben, I got a question for you. You're a Rhodes Scholar, right? But how many times the last 2 weeks somebody said, Ben, I sent you a message. Did you get it? Where'd you send it? I sent it to your email. Which one? One of the seven or eight.
This is becoming quite personal. I feel like you've been to my cloud and to my email.
I sent it to you. Did you get it? Can you send it again? You don't even look anymore because there's so much email, right? So this problem of infobesity, I mean, think about it. There's 176 zettabytes of data on the planet Earth today. If you took DVDs or CDs and stacked them one on top of another today, it would go 128 times between Earth and the moon. And it's grown around relative about 69.6% per year. This is the challenge. We need these superpower tools to be able to be effective. We need to go down through teach them to do the right thing, right? To be able to help. And I'm optimistic like you are too, because I've last year in August, we built the anti-cancer vaccine for my dog, right? In less than 2 weeks, it came up with a solution for the dog at a molecular level and put her full remission to stage 4 cancer. Seriously. Like,
amazing.
Listen, this is a multi-agent large language model that I use directly that we built, right? And I started to think about, I'm not a smart guy like you. I'm not a Rhodes Scholar. I'm a poor country boy, grew up on a farm, right? But if I can do those kind of things, imagine the possibilities. Because now you have superpowers, right?
Yeah.
So, by the way, it just came up, just so you know, the talking about superpowers, my multi-agent model just said to me, Ben, you've shown up to 76% bias reduction without sacrificing accuracy. What's the most surprising real-world effect you've seen from bias unlearning?
So again, like I mentioned earlier, the stats blew even our minds, right? So 76% on the DeepSeek Distilla 1 Llama, 45% on Llama 3. We're going to release soon also a case study about the new open source models by OpenAI. I think like it's one thing to talk about stats and the other thing to like just see how it looks like before and after, right? And we're talking about instances where AI is being deployed in areas that are critical. So it could be loan predictions, it could be underwriting, it could be hiring, it could be for any kind of decision, you know, that's business critical, nationally critical, and so forth. These stats are actually instances where the model, which is being unsupervised aside from guardrails, could give very problematic responses, could reject people from opportunities, and so forth. And just seeing the fact that, like, at point A, it could discriminate against gender, or it could hold a certain political, you know, orientation or bias. And then without actually changing its functionality, making sure that everything remains intact, but the model actually avoids this kind of discrimination, for us, like, it's a very impactful and powerful thing. We talked about healthcare, right? So even like curating the model towards the direction where it will know how to give the right treatment, even if you're coming from a certain minority or you have a condition that the model was not so like trained properly on top of, for us, like that gives us a layer of optimism towards the fact that AI is powerful. It's still flawed at the moment,
novel approach, right? Novel. So the key is to get it to a point where we're coming up with novel solutions to problems, right? So, yeah. By the way, so the AI just my multi-agent, my grandmother, right? I feel like it's my grandmother because we have that kind of relationship. So
we should give it like a catchy name, not like a multi-agent LLM.
Well, actually it has a name, but I'm not going to say it online.
Okay.
It's a little bit, it's my grandmother, you know, my grandmother, Neen. What's the scariest AI behavior you ever seen firsthand?
For me, just like scary to see how easy like it is to manipulate the models. Like we talked about, AI security and guardrails, but just the fact that AI models are not connected to everything. You mentioned cloud, they're connected to cloud, you know, they're connected to our emails. And if it's a bank, it's connected to also financial record. And the ease at which you can manipulate the model. It's same with human beings, right? But you just like have much more instances and much more GPU power to attack models on an ongoing way. So the ease that you can bypass these defenses currently and get almost any information that you want. And I'm saying this, and there's so much research and so many companies, including one that Naftali Bennett, by the way, that you mentioned, the advisors to Lasso Security, which are good friends. So everyone is trying to solve it, and everyone is giving so much proof that AI is still vulnerable. Again, I have an interest in saying this because we try to solve it in a very different approach. Just like seeing the amount of research about just with changing one character or two, suddenly the ML acts in a completely different way. Having all guards down, it's scary, and it's a call for action, and that's why we're here.
So, just wrote to me, if you could make AI forget one thing humanity has ever taught it, what would it be?
Well, I think like, I don't want to create any enemies, but the fact that like Grok entered its Mecha Hitler phase a month ago, right? If we could make it without even entering politics and stuff, but just like, make it not go off a script to this extent and just make sure that it's not discriminating to that level. It would be great.
It's not scary when it's just talking to you, but it's scary when it starts to control things that could impact your lives, right?
Exactly. And we're talking about Grok as like end users, but at the end of the day, some companies are using Grok I was there, a LLM that's operating their agents, their systems. And Grok is one example, but every AI model that exists out there has its own problems, its own vulnerabilities, its own biases. And I still, we still have like some length to go before we reach like a standard that brings a, you know, much more responsible adoption.
So it's just said to me, most surprising industry using machine unlearning.
So I think like the not surprising ones are just like the regulated industries, right? So like the insurance, finance, healthcare, places where they really have low tolerance for risk, be it because of responsibility, be it because of a regulation, a lawsuit, so PR. For us, like, you know, we're starting to push also for interactions with the LM developers themselves, which is for me personally the most exciting part of it, because it will also give a superpower to those who are developing the models that people are consuming. I don't know if those are surprising, because right now unlearning is such a novel, you know, aspect that everything is a surprise, but it is very exciting just like to see it in action and see it roll out.
Yeah, I mean, you know, to be in, I'm a clinical psychologist too, and I think about the term unlearning. There's something else that could be used for that, Ben, seriously, that would be more impactful, you know, and, it, you know, something to think about, you know, just, I don't want to go through it right now because it'll take us another half an hour to go through it. But seriously, unlearning, there's another word that would work a lot better from my perspective. What's your favorite productivity hack as a CEO?
Good thing. I think like I caved in 3-4 months ago and hired like a chief of staff because I feel like I could be more productive, you know, using AI where it should. And I think like one thing that I really embraced is my ADHD. And I think like, I'm not the only one to say it. There's a lot of talk about this right now. But you know, I earlier on in my career, I aspired to be this much more organized, much more methodological person, leader, worker, and so forth. At some point, I acknowledged that I run in chaos. I thrive in chaos. That's how my brain works. That's bring the creativity and so forth. But the right thing to do is to safeguard it with bring a more organized person that understands what you want, puts it into structure using the tools that allow you to do it. So the one hack is just like to embrace your inner traits until we have unlearning for human beings, but then like cover up for your imperfections with people that complement it.
You know, the one thing that I've learned on the AI, and I use it a lot, and I have for years and years, right? But the one thing that's very interesting is that, you know, one of the things in humanity is that we have a lot of questions during our lives and we never have answers, right? Like how many planets in the universe, you know, most people have no idea, right? How many how many planets in the Milky Way galaxy, right? So 100 billion, right? Just in the Milky Way. How many estimated galaxies in the universe? 2.8 trillion. We're a medium-sized galaxy. How many Earth-like planets, Milky Way, 60 billion. And I would have never gone down through and learned about physics and astrophysics and, you know, building a cancer vaccine, those kind of things, if I didn't have these tools. But by the way, they teach you, because the questions that you have, you can answer them instantly and you learn. Your neurons and synapses start snapping a lot faster and you learn. And one of the things we haven't talked about is why, you know, having the, it's like having your mom and dad are great teachers, right? They teach you about life, but having the answers to questions at your fingertips and to be able to understand, it changes everything. It does truly give you superpowers. So if you weren't building Hirundo, what would you be doing right now?
A good question. A lot of thoughts about the thing that you mentioned. So I'll comment first on the thing that you mentioned, and then I'll talk about what would I do if I didn't do Hirundo. Okay, so the first thing is, you know, I think like you're talking, and everyone is talking about AI right now, as we talked about, you know, the World Wide Web, the internet revolution. Right? Information is at your fingertips, the world is connected. Suddenly we move from like a, you know, knowledge being a secluded hierarchical thing to an abundance. And I think at the same time, it's not a silver bullet. So it's not that now that AI is available, everyone is gonna have all of the information actually absorbed. It's just the first step, it's an enabler. But the responsibility is still, 40 human beings, the curiosity, I think, like, is something that, you know, should be encouraged, and it's not to take for granted. And it's one thing that I'm very grateful for my, you know, upbringing. And now regarding the second thing, what would I do if I didn't do it? First of all, like, you've been there. I think, like, entrepreneurship is about. I didn't expect to do Hirundo before I've done Hirundo. It came by a surprise, but once the opportunity was there and everything clicked, and we just started running together, me, Oded, and Misha. So at the same time, I have some ideas, who knows? On the side, I'm running a nonprofit dealing with the access to higher education. I didn't have a lot of like tools to become a Rhodes Scholar, and it was important for me to pay it forward. So I think like at some point, right now it's a side project, very small, very modest, but to make it more meaningful. And second thing, I think like there's so many big challenges that could be solved with creative approaches rather than just chasing their own path. We talked about society's biggest challenges, environment, superintelligence. I'm touching now an aspect of it, but there is many more risks and opportunities that will come, societal gaps, and so forth. So I think I'll stay probably in entrepreneurship for the time being. Will it be in AI infrastructure, or will it be in, you know, bridging over divisions or fighting in one way or another climate change? Could be. But talk to me in like, you know, a decade or so. We'll see what happens after the IPO and what's next.
No, that's fantastic. You know, these tools that are out there. I remember last year in September, I got diagnosed with stage 3 kidney disease. And I put it inside of my multi-agent model. I said, what can I do? Because the doctor said nothing could be done. It was from taking too many ibuprofens at the time for me. Well, anyhow, I put it inside there, and it told me exactly what needed to be done. And it said mesenchymal stem cells from an umbilical cord. And it actually told me the doctor to go to in Thailand exactly that could do it. So I had 100 million stem cells put in twice. I completely got rid of my stage 3 kidney disease. And then all the wrinkles went out of my face. Everything started to change. I can ride a bike 50 miles now. I mean, everything started to change. And these kind of things are right at our hand. And if we use these like an oracle to be able to help us with our lives, to live longer, to build better lives, to be able to help our neighbors, to be able to go down through and make this world a better place, because it is one planet. And we're, you know, we've been destroying it. We've got to turn it around. And tools like what you have to be able to, you know, help it unlearn and to be able to help teach it to do better things are going to be critically important as we guide it to so that it doesn't make the bad mistakes that we've made. It helps us with good things. So I appreciate you taking your time, Ben, out of your schedule. What's the best way for people to get a hold of you? And closing thoughts.
Right. So first of all, like get in touch with me in any way possible. My email address is ben@hirundo. Hirundo is hirundo.io. Or via LinkedIn. I think like on the post about this episode, you put the link to my LinkedIn, but it's Ben Luria. You can send me a pigeon. I do take note of my emails despite losing track of everything. Regarding closing notes, first of all, I think like it's been a pleasure, right? I think like a lot of these podcasts, it's just like going through what we do, very like linear. I love that it's an open conversation and we talk about every subject out there that exists in the world. I'm happy that you are healthy now. So thanks for sharing it. And if I want to bring like one message is again, it's almost like a funny tagline, making it forget. We know that. We know that we bring something that's a bit like weird to the ecosystem. And at the same time, what we're solving is one of the biggest challenges in AI infrastructure. So if you're an innovator in AI, if you believe that AI could be deployed more responsibly, should be deployed more responsibly, if you tried the existing approach and you realize that it solves 80% of the problems, but the 20% that it doesn't solve, the most critical ones, take a look at our website, at our research, check out some of our unlearned models that are available on Hugging Face. You know, we love the early birds. We love the early adopters. We believe that's how we make a difference to make a new standard for AI adoption in enterprise. So talk to us. This is a very exciting journey, and I'm always happy to share a bit of what it looks like from the inside. So thank you, Gary, for the opportunity above all.
Yeah, thank you. Thanks, Ben, for taking time out of your busy schedule to join us. And thanks to all my audience for joining one more time, GSD Presents Top Global Startups. My name is Gary Fowler, and I'm your host. Stay happy, stay safe, and stay healthy. And I'll be back to you again soon with another exciting edition. Ben, if you want to stay on for a few minutes after the show, we can talk. All right. Thanks, everybody. Take care of yourselves and have a nice rest of the day.